So good afternoon. It's a huge pleasure to be back here. I was so pleased to be invited to come and talk to you all, partly because I just want to say thank you to the Yale Geology and Geophysics Department. This is where I got my start in science. I had never heard of geology before I walked in here in my sophomore year for Brian Skinner's Introduction to Geology class, and you know, I fell in love with the whole idea of studying the Earth's interior and plate tectonics, and I'm still doing that today. And my very first research experience was working in Bob Gordon's lab, measuring the area of drainage basins. And even though that's an area I didn't pursue for further research, I mean, just the whole process of research that I got exposed to that summer was just very fun and exciting. I loved the idea that you were creating new knowledge. And, you know, so again, just many thanks to everybody here who made, you know, the rest of my life possible, basically. So. So now the question I'm going to look at is, why is the lithosphere strong and why is the asthenosphere weak? And I picked this one because it's sort of one in the sort of long chain of things that connect back to sort of the fundamental theory of plate tectonics. Basically, the question we're asking here is, why are the lithospheric plates plate-like? And before I go on, I just want to recognize a really wonderful group of students, David Apt, Heather Ford, Scott French, and Kate Reichert, who are all PhD students at Brown, and Stefan Rondinet, who did a postdoc with me a number of years ago. All of their efforts are represented in the work I'm about to show you. So this profile here goes from about 0 kilometers down to about 1,000 kilometers, and what you're looking at are temperature contours. And this is a numerical model that Sarah Zoronic calculated for her PhD thesis, which shows a lithospheric layer, a cool thermal boundary layer at the surface. It's thicker here. This is meant to represent the thicker lithosphere beneath the continental craton, thinner lithosphere at the orogenic margins. And then these white lines here basically show the advection of the asthenosphere beneath that. So in this reference frame, the lithosphere is fixed and the asthenosphere is flowing beneath it. But the point I want to draw your attention to is the quite broad temperature gradient where we go from cool lithosphere to warm asthenosphere. So when you define the lithosphere in terms of temperature structure, you end up with a very gradual base to the lithosphere. So, you know, in introductory geology courses, the notion is still primarily that the lithosphere is strong because it's cold, therefore it's more rigid relative to the warmer asthenosphere. And what I hope to show you today is going to challenge that notion. So just let's take now a look at how seismologists can study this problem. So up here is a very simple schematic. It's like the right half of the diagram I just showed you, where here's thinner to thicker lithosphere and the asthenosphere moving with respect to the lithosphere. Now, if you look at sort of a typical geotherm or temperature gradient through the lithosphere, we'll have sort of a smooth increase in temperature to the base of the lithosphere, and then when we get into the convecting mantle, you achieve something which is close to an adiabatic gradient. Now, what that will produce is a very gradual drop in viscosity. That's basically the stiffness of the mantle rocks. It controls their ability to flow. However, if you create a chemical distinction between the lithosphere and the asthenosphere, for example, if you say when you create the lithosphere at a mid-ocean ridge, you pull water out of the mantle, you dehydrate the mantle, so the lithosphere is a relatively dry, depleted layer relative to a more hydrated and fertile asthenosphere, you can sharpen up that contrast in viscosity. And I just want to make the point here that when I'm talking about a hydrated asthenosphere, I'm not talking about sort of free water at grain boundaries. What we're really talking is about water molecules that have been dissolved into nominally anhydrous minerals like olivine and orthopyroxene. So now if we want to make the viscosity contrast still stronger, if we add a little bit of partial melt to the asthenosphere, which is this lighter yellow line here, we can make the asthenosphere even weaker with respect to the lithosphere. So then what does that do to shear wave velocities? And I want to recognize the work of Shun Corrado here, because he really sort of pioneered looking at the effect of water and olivine on what it will do to shear wave velocity. So for instance, here, if you have this velocity gradient corresponding to what you'd get solely from temperature, you have a very gradual decrease in velocity from the lithosphere to the asthenosphere. If, however, you allow the asthenosphere to be more hydrated, you'll get a sharper decrease in velocity at the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. And Shen had a very nice paper, I think it was in 1997 or 1998, that showed that. And then again, if you add a little bit of melt on top of that into the asthenosphere, you can get an even sharper and greater drop in shear wave velocity. So basically what we're doing is trying to look for essentially the sharpness of the velocity gradient at the base of the lithosphere, at the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary, and see what that tells us about the properties that define the lithosphere. Now, there are many seismic measures that show us distinctions between the lithosphere and asthenosphere. For instance, surface waves are a wonderful tool in some respects. This is the surface wave work of Nettles and Jawanski. These are now showing profiles across the northern part of North America, the Canadian Shield here. These images, the blues are fast shear wave velocities, the yellows are slow shear wave velocities. Just focus on this panel, which shows isotropic velocities. And basically, you see thicker lithosphere beneath the craton, thinner lithosphere beneath the origin. And when you look at the gradient here, it looks quite gradual. So, for example, that would correspond to this like green line here, where we have a drop in shear wave velocity from the lithosphere into the asthenosphere, but it occurs over tens of kilometers. Well, the trick with surface waves is it you can't really tell the difference between a boundary that actually looks like that and a boundary that's very sharp. Surface waves simply can't resolve that. So, in turn, we turn to scattered waves. And just let me sum up the questions that we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at how deep is the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary, and in particular, we're going to be focusing beneath continental regions. How sharp is the velocity gradient at the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary? And then what does that tell us about why the asthenosphere is weak? Is it a purely thermal gradient? Is it because we have a hydrated asthenosphere? Or is it because we have melt in the asthenosphere? Okay, so I know we're short on time, so I'll be just very brief here. The phases we look at are S to P or P to S converted waves. So, for example, you can have a shear wave coming up through the Earth. It hits a contrast in velocity. Some of that energy is going to convert to a P wave, which then continues up to a seismic station. The same thing happens for P waves. They can convert into S waves. So what we can do is basically take, for example, an S to P phase and reference it back to its parent S phase using a process called deconvolution. We correct for the move out between different waves, and then we migrate them to depth, and we get images like this, which are called receiver functions. And in these positive increases in velocity, so say from a slower crust to a faster mantle, will show up as a red bump, so that's a positive velocity discontinuity. But a drop in velocity, say from a faster lithosphere to a slower asthenosphere, are going to show up as a negative phase. And this is from a station in western Massachusetts, and you're looking at waveforms from over 400 events here, and you see a very nice clear MOHO. You see a discontinuity, which actually, even though it's right in the wake of the MOHO, is a real phase. And then you see this phase here, which we characterize as the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary, because it falls smack dab in the middle of that broader gradient defined by surface waves in the region. Okay, so that's the kind of data we're looking at. So now let's look at a roundup of some results. So this is work that Kate Reichert did for her PhD thesis. Actually, it's a very nice story. She then went on to do a postdoc with Peter Shearer, who just spoke. So this is part of her work at Brown, and what you're looking at here is a three-dimensional image where this surface shows topography. So here's the station HRV. We're sitting roughly there right now. Okay, and this is what the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary looks like beneath our feet. That's this surface here. Okay, so off of the Atlantic coast, it lies at a depth of about 90 kilometers, and it dips gradually to the west to a depth of about 110 kilometers. And we know that because of both these S to P and P to S scattered waves. So these circles here show the points where the individual waves are hitting the boundary. They convert to their daughter phase, and then they're recorded at the station. And then we're simply mapping the depth where those phases seem to convert onto this surface. So that's nice. We know where the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary is. But the really exciting part of this result was we can model the waveforms that we recorded to constrain the sharpness of this gradient. So when we jointly modeled both the P to S and S to P arrivals, we found that it's actually a remarkably sharp gradient. We have a velocity drop of somewhere between 5 and 10%. That's a drop in velocity, shear wave velocity, but it must occur over less than 11 kilometers. That's much sharper than is consistent with any kind of thermal model. And in fact, it tells us that here, this velocity drop must be caused by some presence of either anomalously hydrated asthenosphere or maybe a small fraction of partial melt in the asthenosphere. So that's beneath the northeastern U.S. Okay. More broadly, now we've looked all across the entire United States. This is work that David App did for his PhD work. And what you're looking at in this map here, each colored point, again, represents one of those conversion points where you have an S wave. These are all S to P results now, scattering to a P wave. And we've color-coded them by the depth of the phase. So, for example, in the western U.S., we have lithospheric thicknesses that are about 50 to maybe 70 kilometers depth on average, though there are some coherent spots where the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary looks a little bit deeper. However, what we see is that when we move into the eastern seaboard, we see phases that are more on the order of about 70 to 110 kilometers depth. But the thing is that when we get into the regions of really thick lithosphere within the craton, if you look at these depths, they're still in the 70 to 110 kilometer depth range, but we know the lithosphere there is much thicker. So, for example, if we look at this station from Southern California, here's the negative phase in the S to P results that pins the depth of lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary, and here it falls within that gradient from the fast lithosphere to the slow asthenosphere, so we interpret this as the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. However, beneath the craton, again we see a negative phase. It's a little bit deeper, but if you look at this absolute shear wave velocity profile, this is from the model produced by Hayu Yan and Barbara Romanowitz at Berkeley, the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary sort of potential depth ranges in here, we see no energy, no converted energy from that depth. Rather, we see this much shallower phase, and this surely, yes, it's a discontinuity, but it's within the body of the lithosphere. And when you look across the whole continent, in fact, nowhere beneath the craton do we see a strong converted phase from the base of the lithosphere. So what does that tell us? That tells us beneath the younger continent, yes, we do see these phases. They're at a depth that makes sense for the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. Because they exist at all, when we model them, they tell us that the velocity gradient is less than about 30 kilometers because we're just looking at S to P here. The constraints aren't quite as tight. But the phases are large enough that the magnitude of the velocity gradients still suggests that you can't do it just with temperature, that there still is some extra hydration or perhaps a little melt in the asthenosphere. But a very interesting result is nowhere beneath the cratons, beneath the thick lithosphere, do we see a sharp S to P conversion. And then that tells us that that gradient, in fact, can be much, much more gradual. So there, the boundary could, in fact, be purely thermal. Okay, so that is telling us that perhaps there is a completely different physical definition to the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary, depending on the tectonic province you're looking at. This is now some work that Heather Ford has just completed in Australia. So let's first look at this profile here. This is along the Phanerozoic edge of eastern Australia, which has seen much more recent tectonism. This part of Australia is both Proterozoic and then Archean age craton. Okay, so along this profile, we have a beautiful positive MOHO phase, and then this is our negative lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary phase. Again, that falls within the surface wave-defined velocity gradient, so we interpret it as the LAB. And actually, a really cool thing about this is the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary is shallowest here and here, which corresponds to this receiver function and that receiver function, which actually correlates with the age of the most recent magmatism. Okay. But again, when we look across the craton, for example, at these three stations, which correspond to these three stations here, we see a shallower phase, but no significant energy from any depth range that could correspond to the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. So basically what we're seeing is a very sharp boundary in eastern Australia. Again, it suggests the presence of water or melt in the asthenosphere, but a much more gradual lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary beneath the craton, which, again, is consistent by temperature with temperature alone. And I just want to point out that when Kate went and did her postdoc with Peter Shearer, she did a very lovely global study of P to S conversions. And I would say that in a broad sense, these results are similar to the results that Kate and Peter obtained in terms of there not being sort of deep lithosphere-asthenosphere boundaries beneath cratons. So, again, I think the two sets of results are quite consistent. And I know we're short on time, so I think I'll just skip this part, and we'll just go right to the conclusions, which is just to sum up, beneath relatively recently deformed or Phanerozoic age continental regions, we do see a very sharp lithosphere-cenosphere boundary, which suggests the presence of water or melt in the cenosphere. However, beneath cratonic regions, there's no phase at depths comparable to the base of the fast lithosphere. And this tells us that either the velocity gradient is very small or gradual, both of which would be consistent with a purely thermal boundary. We do, however, see a very widespread, consistent velocity drop internal to the lithosphere at depths of about 60 to 115 kilometers. And we actually have some ideas for what that could be, but I think I'll just leave it at that for now. Thanks very much.